Hello, my name is Dan Heath, and this is the podcast, The Power of Moments for Education. In this podcast, we're going to discuss how to improve the experience of students in school, but also how to improve the experience of teachers and even administrators as well. This podcast is intended to be a supplement for the book, The Power of Moments. So hopefully you've got a copy of that. If you don't, I would encourage you to pause the podcast and read at least the first chapter before continuing. That first chapter is available for free on our website, heathbrothers.com, in the resources area, same place that you presumably downloaded this podcast. So with that, let's dive in. And as inspiration, I want to share a quote with you that appears in chapter 3 of the book from Jeff Gilbert, who's the principal of Hillsdale High. That's a public high school in San Mateo, California. He said, "School needs to be so much more like sports. In sports, there's a game. It's in front of an audience. But we run school like it's nonstop practice. You never get a game. Nobody would go out for the basketball team if you never had a game. What is the game for our students?" Isn't that striking? In school, we spend the vast majority of our time in the classroom. But what do we remember from our education? Inevitably, it's things from outside the classroom. Prom and musicals and presentations and parties and exhibitions and sporting events. And what do all those things have in common? Well, they're all peak experiences, other than the parties, probably. There's a sense of competition, or at least some pressure involved. We've got to bring our best game. They're public. They're social events. And there's also a sense of pomp and circumstance. I mean, imagine, of those things I listed, how often we're actually wearing different clothes. Think of the costumes for the musical and the uniforms for sporting events and those horrible dresses and suits for prom. So I want to make the case in this podcast that schools should create more peak moments in the classroom, not just outside of it. So what does it mean to create peak moments for students? Well, it means that some days are held above others. Some moments are invested in more than others. These are the memorable, meaningful moments, not just the everyday practices, as Jeff Gilbert talked about. What's an example of this? Well, one of my favorite examples is in the book. It's in chapter 3. It's about the trial of human nature that's held every year at Hillsdale High. If you don't have a copy of the book, I strongly encourage you to seek one out just to read this story, because in some ways it's the centerpiece of the argument I'm making in this podcast. Two teachers, one English teacher and one social studies teacher, set out to create an academic moment as memorable as prom. And as you'll see in the story, they succeeded. In fact, they succeeded so well that some of their colleagues who taught upperclassmen began to try to create their own peaks, and they launched something they called Senior Exhibition, which was a project where a senior would get to pick their own research topic, explore it over a period of months, and then prepare a defense of their research in front of an audience, right? Starting to sound more like a game. There's a sense of pressure. There's an audience that watches. You have the parents that have already seen you in dance recitals and basketball games over the years finally get to see something that you're learning. Let me tell you a different story, though, that's not in the book. And this comes from a school called the Loudoun Academy of Science, which is a science magnet school near Washington, D.C. There's a math teacher there who did something absolutely stunning on the day in calculus when you're introduced to functions. So I can still remember as a student taking calculus just how odd that function notation is. You know what I'm talking about, the f of x. And even that phrase, f of x, what does that even mean? It was all like a foreign language. But listen to what this teacher did. She set up aquariums, or aquaria perhaps, in her classroom, filled with crickets. So the students come in and there's this kind of mystery. What are all these crickets doing here? And she said, "These tanks have been outfitted with a little knob that allows you to adjust the temperature in the tank. And the question we're going to pursue today is, does the temperature in the tank affect the rate at which crickets chirp?" So it's kind of interesting. She, in fact, had the students make some guesses. You know, if it gets hotter in the tank, will they chirp faster or slower? And so what they did was they gathered some data. Like good scientists, they had a hypothesis, and now it's time to gather evidence. And so they would take the rate of chirping at room temperature. You know, they would listen for about a minute, count the number of chirps, write it down. Then they would turn up the heat a little bit, maybe a couple of degrees, and then they would listen again for another minute and write down the answer, and then turn it up another couple of degrees and write it down. And pretty soon they had data points for, say, 10 different temperatures. And then the teacher said, what we're going to do next is we're going to create a function that associates the number of chirps per minute by crickets for a given temperature. So she said a function is like a little machine where we input one type of data. In this case, we're inputting the temperature, and the machine outputs a different type of data, which is the number of chirps per minute. And she said, in the real world, what we do is we input the data that you've just collected into a software program, and the software program tells us what the function will be. And the neat thing about a function is, once you have a function, you can input temperatures you haven't even tested and get a reasonable answer back. So maybe you tested 71 and 73 and 75 and 77 degrees Fahrenheit, but you could plug in 72, something you never tested, and still get a trustworthy answer. That's the power of a function. And so she gave them a couple of examples. She said, you know, plug in 80 degrees into your function and tell me how many chirps per minute we would predict. And so they plugged in into the equation, which they already knew how to do. They gave answers. And she said, okay, plug in 90 degrees into the function. Tell me what you get back. So they did that. They got their calculators out and they came back with an answer. And then she said, plug 1,000 degrees into your function. And so they got out their calculators, they start computing, and they come up with this really, really, really high number of chirps. And she says, aha, we've got to be careful here. Just as with all math, we've got to use our judgment. She says, think about it again. If we turn up the temperature in these tanks to 1,000 degrees, what's going to be the rate of chirping? The rate of chirping is going to be zero, because every last cricket's going to be dead. She says, let's never forget that we should always use our own wisdom as well as these equations when we're trying to solve problems. Now think about that class. I mean, that's something that students are going to remember for years afterwards. And it's such an important day, because that's the day that the concept of a function has to be imprinted into their brain. And now they've got the entire scope of the function concept, where a function comes from, what you can use it for, what the limits of a function are, all in one lesson. Now, you can't run every math class of the year like that. It's just too resource intensive. But this is such a critical day, it's worth building a peak. I want to give you another example from a place called High Tech High, which is a network of public charter schools in San Diego. And they believe strongly in the value of project-based learning. So I'll give you one example that happened with sixth graders. They start by asking the kids to brainstorm questions that they have about the world. And you can imagine some of the crazy questions that come out of sixth graders' mouths. The kids then categorized them into different themes, and they started using some consensus-building strategies that they had learned to identify what topic they were going to select to do a community project around. And wouldn't you know it, the question, or the topic rather, that they chose to pursue was all the ways the world could end and what people could do to prevent those various scenarios. So the kids decided not only on the theme, but they also decided on the product. What is it that we're going to build to address this topic? And they were inspired by a magazine called National Geographic Nature, and they said they wanted to create a shiny, glossy magazine themed around the end of the world. And so the kids got to break into separate groups, and some of them studied black holes, some of them studied deforestation, some studied malaria, some polar ice extinction. And they had to put together a magazine article based in scientific fact. And one of the prerequisites was that they had interviews with at least two experts in the field. So picture it, you know, these sixth graders are Skyping with professors in India. Some of them went on a field trip to a science lab at UCSD. These are sixth graders cold calling adults for help with their projects. They wrote up the articles. They did all of the scientific illustrations themselves. They had to learn how to design layouts for a magazine. I mean, think of all the software that's involved there. And then at the end of this, they had a presentation of these magazines on the school's exhibition night. So they actually had the magazines printed up. They sold them to parents and other members of the community who attended. And they set up a booth where they talked about some of their findings and some of the things they had published in the magazine. They had a big poster printout of an excerpt from the magazine. And then the audience is coached on the kinds of questions to ask them, you know, questions about black holes or deforestation or what have you, so that they can have a quality discussion in public. Now, isn't that just amazing? I mean, think about that project and everything that's baked into that. They have to go through multiple revisions. They have to learn to take feedback from different sources. They have to learn how to build consensus with different people lobbying for different topics. They have to learn how to brainstorm creatively about what goes in and what doesn't go in. They have to learn to conceptualize a project, to take it from a good idea on a whiteboard to a physical product in your hands. As part of that, they have to learn project management and deadlines. You know, when do you have to have the layouts ready to get to the printer? Of course, they have to learn grammar. You know, you can't have a magazine that's full of grammatical and spelling errors. You have to learn layout skills and design skills. You have to learn presentation skills for defending your work in public. You even have to learn marketing and pricing skills. You know, what do you set the price for this magazine at if you want to sell some to the public? Not to mention, you learn how to communicate with adults who are your interviewees and your partners and your vendors. To me, that is just extraordinary. That is a perfectly designed peak moment that allows many of the skills that we teach in this rote practice form to happen via osmosis in pursuit of something the students themselves have designed and that they have natural motivation to produce. Now, are all of these things practical? I can hear some of you thinking, well, that would never work in my district, or we don't have the money for that, or we don't have the time for that. And I think to some extent you're probably right. I mean, some of these schools are different. The Loudoun Academy, it's a public school, but they have their own admissions process. So they're getting a different pool of students, and they have an awful lot of resources to use. High Tech High is not so different. They have the same pool of students as any other public school. It's a lottery system. But, of course, they have more leeway in designing the curriculum. But I would remind you that Hillsdale High is just a straight-up public high school with the same resources as most schools have, the same population that most schools have. It is not a school that is benefiting from an extraordinary application process and or an extraordinary set of resources. Some schools will have greater and lesser abilities to act on these concepts that we're talking about. But I think it's fair to say that every school in some form can embrace the idea of peak moments. Peak moments is not an idea for elite schools. It's an idea for every school. Now, I should also say, I have no idea whether peak moments improve standardized test scores at the state level. And in fact, my suspicion is they probably don't. And here's where we get into a whole can of worms, and this is where I just interject my own opinion that you didn't really ask for. But I think the main reason they don't improve standardized state test scores, if indeed they don't, is because most of those standardized tests are testing absurd things. You know, vast collections of knowledge that are utterly useless for living a productive and satisfying life. So if you gave me a choice for my daughter of acing the state standardized test scores, or getting a B or a C on the state standardized test scores and having the ability to work with a group to create something great that's creative and having her be motivated to go to school and having her be proud of the magazine she's produced and having her understand how things work in the adult world and how to reach out to a professor in India and how a magazine gets designed. Boy, I'll tell you, there is absolutely no question that I would want her to have the latter. I suspect many of you are the same. I do want to empathize with you that that may not be your world right now. If you're the principal of a school, you can't just kind of opt out of the state standardized test scores. I understand that's how you're judged. But here's what I'm saying. Do something, not nothing. You don't have to re-architect your school to be high tech high. That may not be in your selection set right now. But what you can do is emulate what schools like Hillsdale High are doing. In fact, there's a movement underway sponsored by the Hewlett Foundation and others. It's called Public Presentations of Learning. Remember that senior exhibition idea I mentioned earlier? That's the gist. And what they're saying is, You know, let's give students a chance to show off what they've learned. The same way we give them a chance to show off their swimming skills and their dramatic skills and their basketball skills, let's let them show off what they can do. And so there's a website called shareyourlearning.org where you can learn a bunch of the things that other schools have tried. There are toolkits there that you can employ in your own districts. To me, this is something every school can do, regardless of your resource constraints, regardless of how much or little you obsess about standardized test scores. Give this a shot. All right, let's pivot for a second and talk about teachers. You know, we shouldn't just have a school that delivers peak moments for students. We should have schools that deliver peak moments for teachers. And the first thing I would add is everything we've talked about so far is also effective at delivering peaks for teachers. The two teachers that created The Trial of Human Nature, Greg Jurelis and Susan Bedford, this is a peak for them every year. I mean, this is their baby. They get to see it enacted every single year. And is it a lot of work? Of course it is. But you remember the expression of the drama teacher on the night of the musical, that pride, that exhilaration, that exhaustion? I mean, that's a peak moment. They've worked hard for this. Now, let me go a bit further, though. Why don't we have a teacher exhibition the same way that we have a senior exhibition, a chance for teachers to present something cool that they've tried that semester? You know, maybe it's toward the end of the semester when things are winding down and it's just teachers only, and they have a chance to get up and share something that they played around with. You know, imagine the math teacher coming up and say, "Hey, I tried this thing with crickets and tanks, and you wouldn't believe how well this worked." Now, I would encourage you with something like that, just start with volunteers. I realize your teachers are overburdened. They've got 100 things to do, and they're always dealing with shifting standards. Let people opt in, you know, even if it's only 5 or 6 or 10 teachers who are excited enough to try to create a peak in a given semester, that's still plenty to get this going. And my prediction is those teachers will start a snowballing process that every semester attracts more teachers voluntarily, because this is naturally motivating stuff. This is not another state standard. This is about how do you do things that excite you about your career and make you feel good about the work you're doing. Another idea, you know, they have these teacher days and teacher appreciation weeks, and my sense is some schools take these really seriously and some kind of don't. I would encourage you, if you're an administrator, you need to have at least one day a year where it's all about the teachers. I mean, get your students writing notes to the teachers, getting them singing songs, doing performances. I mean, you need to really spoil your teachers. The teacher day that I saw was on the calendar in May, which to me seems too late. The end of the year is just a natural moment of relief for teachers. You're almost done, and you know, the students are starting to appreciate you a little more at that point. We need a teacher day more like the middle of the year when you're only halfway through the slog. What if on that day teachers actually got to sit and the students taught the class? You know, call it pamper your teacher day. And the teacher comes in, they take a chair wherever they like in the classroom. They get to sit there with a Diet Coke and a snack while their students teach something. And not only would that be kind of fun and would break the script for the teachers, it would also be a good chance for students to practice some of those skills we were talking about earlier, you know, formulating a lesson, being able to speak in public, coordinating with other students. It could be a peak for both students and teachers. Another thing I would suggest is a gratitude day. In chapter 7 of the book, we talk about how to write a gratitude letter and how powerful writing a gratitude letter can be. Isn't this something we should be practicing? And I think this might be something that would work for both students and teachers, you know, just to take a moment to say thanks to someone that's been important in their lives. And finally, I want to remind you of something that appears in chapter 11 of the book, which is the idea of the parent-teacher visit. You may remember this came in the context of the Stanton Elementary School in Washington, D.C. that was really struggling. And the parent-teacher visit turned out to be a profoundly powerful tool in turning around that school's performance. So in those parent-teacher visits, this happens before the semester starts in the fall, and the teachers go to their incoming students' parents' homes. And they sit, you know, on the couch with the parent, and they ask 4 questions, tell me about your students, or sorry, your child's experiences in school, and tell me about yours. Second, tell me your hopes and dreams for your child's future. Third, what do you want your child to be someday? And fourth, what do I need to do to help your child learn more effectively? And what they discovered was, even though this sounds so simple and may only take an hour, it had just a magnified impact on the school's performance and on the students' willingness to participate and learn. Moments of connection, as we see again and again in the book, can be both brief and extraordinary. Relationships can form and deepen very quickly. And look, I realize this may not be possible for high school teachers who may have 100 different incoming students in a semester, but at the very least, I would strongly encourage anybody in the elementary grades to seriously consider that idea. All right, let me close with some ideas for administrators. I promised that earlier. My favorite idea for administrators is, especially if you're an administrator, which I suspect if you're listening to this podcast, you're someone who kind of empathizes with this idea of creating more peaks and you could imagine it working for your school. Maybe you have colleagues who aren't quite as far along the trail as you and you're wondering, how could I convince them to join me in this noble journey? Let me give you a solution for that. I mentioned the Hewlett Foundation earlier in the context of their work on public presentations of learning. They sponsored an idea called Shadow Your Student, which is a day when principals or assistant principals spend the entire day with one student, starting at their home in the morning, you know, riding the bus with them all the way to the end of the school, getting them home again, sit through every period, accompany them to lunch, go with them to recess, the whole bit. In fact, there's a great video of this on the PBS NewsHour. If you just Google PBS NewsHour Shadow Student, it should pop right up. And it's a fascinating clip. You'll get to see the principal following this one ninth grader. And here's what happens. The principal, you know, sitting through class after class of this rote learning, one point in the day in particular, the principal's eyes just kind of noticeably start dimming. You know, it's just like she's losing energy. It's a two-hour math block right over the lunch period. And she even admits, you know, because it was during the lunch block, the bell kept ringing to signal other lunch periods, but it wasn't theirs. And so it's like every time the bell would ring, her eyes would look up hopefully and then be crushed when she realized, no, we've got an hour more to go. What does this produce? What it produces is a desire for the kinds of peak moments that we've been describing, right? It's something that we talk about in the book as tripping over the truth, that it's far more powerful for someone to discover an idea for themselves than it is to just hear about it. So you could try persuading your colleagues about the importance of peak moments, or you could have them shadow a student for a day, see how many aspects of the day are still rote, still monotonous, and have them discover the inspiration themselves for more interactive learning, more collaborative learning, more self-directed learning. It's my suspicion that there is no one on your administration team who could survive 6 months of the normal classroom experience. We simply have grown out of that as adults, and yet we ask 8-year-olds and 13-year-olds and 16-year-olds to endure it every day. And just a sampling of that experience, my prediction is, will be enough to get them on your team and on the path toward creating more peak moments. Okay, I hope you found this podcast helpful. I'm going to close with some potential next steps. And I'm going to give you a small, medium, and large version of this, just depending on your personal appetite for it. The small version is, I've shot a YouTube video with the title, Is Your School All Practice and No Game? That reiterates some of what we've seen here. It also tells a short version of the Trial of Human Nature story. It's like 4 minutes long, super easy. You can get a team together or just circulate the link, maybe have a short discussion. The whole thing could take 15 minutes. The medium version is, distribute chapter 1 of the book, which of course is available for free, as I mentioned. It would be great if you also had chapter 3. I don't have an easy solution for that. If someone has a copy, you know, you have my blessing to Xerox chapter 3 without official permission. Or, of course, if people have copies of the book, just ask them to read chapter 1 and chapter 3, because chapter 3 is where the trial of human nature and the emphasis on peaks is. And then maybe couple that with this podcast and hold a discussion afterwards. So that's, you're probably talking about 2 hours-ish all in for the medium version. The large version is what I'm secretly hoping you'll do, which is have your teams read the whole book. There is a book club guide on our website that you can use to guide discussions. You could throw in this podcast as well. That's going to take hours of work, of course. But then the really important thing is that it's just a prelude to action, that you use some of what you've learned and some of what you've discussed to try something. And I think if you're looking for a place to just get your feet wet without too much disruption, without too much groaning from staff, get a set of volunteer teachers. Again, I don't think this is something that has to be mandated to be effective. Get a set of volunteer teachers who want to play around with the idea of sharing your learning, those public presentations of learning. I hope you found this helpful. I appreciate your attention, and I would love to hear from you if you do try something like this at your school on whatever level, whether you're a math teacher who decided to create a peak moment or a superintendent who decided you needed more peak moments district-wide. Shoot me an email, will you? I'm at dan@heathbrothers.com. Thanks again.